to be with you this morning. This is our first time in Canada meeting in convention with the brethren here. And needless to say, we're very pleased, Ruth and I and Ben, to be here. We bring the Christian love and greetings of the Northwest Indiana Bible students with whom we meet. And before we go any further, we'd like to also invite you. We're part of the I.O. Convention arrangement, and we'd like to invite you to the Valparaiso, Indiana Convention, July 27th through 30th. And to make it more inviting to the Canadian, to the Canadian brethren, we've moved it about 300 miles closer. So it's only a hop, skip, and a jump on the way from here. Our text is from Jude, verses 5 through 7. Now I desire to remind you, though you were once for all fully informed, that he who saved a people out of the land of Egypt afterward destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels that did not keep their own position but left their proper dwelling have been kept by him in eternal chains in the nether gloom until the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise acted immorally and indulged in unnatural lust, served as an example by undergoing a punishment of age-lasting fire. This tells us of the judgment of the great day, that the angels would be restrained until that time, and our understanding is that there would be a loosing in that judgment period. And he likens this to the lesson of Sodom and Gomorrah. Just like to refer to Genesis 18, verses 20 to 21. Genesis 18, 20 to 21. Then the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry which has come to me, and if not, I will know. Well, that's kind of a strange way of putting it. The Lord is here saying, well, I'm going to go down and see what's going on there. And if it's true, like what I've heard, I'll know it. Well, we think, of course, the Lord knew exactly what was going on there. But what this is saying is that he's going down and see what the present state of activity is. And sure enough, when the angel of the Lord, the two angels, arrived in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, they put in their worst performance that very night. In other words, there was no improvement, but there was a drop in their performance, and they became worse and more evil and put in their very worst performance on the very night that the angels were there. And so we believe that's a kind of a lesson of the judgment of the great day, that during the time of the Lord's presence and they're being given greater liberties, they're going to put in their worst performance. Now, it was Brother Russell's thought that this would be the period in which the angels would receive greater liberty, and that it would result in a last replay, just like here in Sodom. The angels would be allowed to put in their last performance, as it were, before they were destroyed. Now, there is not too much said about the destruction of the angels, the fallen angels, but Brother Russell's thought was, and we believe it was a correct thought, that it would be in this period of time that they would put in their worst performance and be destroyed. Now, the reason for that, scripturally, is very plain. The scriptures don't exactly say when they're going to be destroyed, but the scriptures do not state that the angels are cast into the bottomless pit with Satan. And the scriptures do not say that they are loosed out of the bottomless pit whenever the 1,000 years are ended. So scripturally, what happens? Well, we know they're destroyed. The demons themselves say that, you know, when Jesus was present at the first advent, they said, well, we know thee who thou art. Art thou come to destroy us before the time? So they were expecting to be destroyed. And they knew it was probably premature for their destruction then, but it would be at his second advent, and we believe it's in the early stages of the second advent that they would receive their liberty, they would put in their worst performance, and it would be consummated in their destruction. There would be no purpose. We can't conceive of the thought that Satan would be in the abyss and the fallen angels would be free during the millennial age to harass people. That's a kind of an unthinkable thought. What would they be doing here? And so the pastor's thought, and I think it's a correct one, even though the scriptures don't exactly say when they're destroyed, but we believe that the judgment of the great day would have to do with a time in which the demons would be, as it were, given liberties to express themselves, and there would be a reading of what takes place, just as there was here in Sodom. The Lord would see what they were going to do, how they were going to perform, and at the end of the performance, they are taken out of the way. And so we believe we're standing right at the threshold of the destruction of the fallen angels. Now, Jude reminded us to contend for the faith that was once delivered unto the saints. And in verse 3, he turns to the darkness and the judgment outside the faith once delivered to the saints. And Jude's lesson is confirmed in 2 Peter, the second chapter, verse 4. He says, if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartarus and committed them to the pits of nether gloom, to be kept until the judgment of the great day. Both Jude and Peter seem to indicate that they would be restrained until the judgment of the great day, and then those chains they'd be unshackled step by step, and they would be given greater liberties, and then there would be a reading as to their final performance, and then the Lord would manifest his judgment in their destruction. The lesson is clear. God did not spare the angels who sinned. He did not make any allowance for their devious conduct because they were of a higher order than man. They weren't given any special considerations. When they sinned, they were dealt with very, very strictly. Both Satan and the angels who left their estate showed a serious disregard for the Lord's will. They had forgotten who was in charge, who was the great lawgiver, and who was the judge. And it indicates, too, that they showed a certain dissatisfaction with the Lord, and they felt that somehow, given their choices, they could improve their happiness, they could improve their circumstances by taking a choice contrary to the Lord's will. You know, Jesus and the scriptures clearly teach that man must live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, and that applies to the angels too. No one can live and enjoy happiness except they proceed and be governed by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Now, remember when the 70 disciples returned to Jesus, he had sent them out, and they came back to him, and they were just happy, they were exuberant. And they said, this is in Luke 10:17 and 18, They said, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. What power! Even the demons are subject to us. And they were feeling the effects of the great power that they had been imbued with. And Jesus said, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. What a statement. Now, Jesus referred to Satan's fall from the brightness and honor of heaven to his present position of going to and forth in the earth, walking up and down on it, as we read in Job 1:1. From being a glorious heavenly figure to imprisonment here on earth, bound to earth's atmosphere, no longer free to commingle with the heavenly host, but like a leper standing afar off and being kept from fellowship with the heavenly host. And then Jesus said to them in Luke 10:20, do not rejoice in this. That is, in the fact that even the demons are subject to you. That the spirits are subject to you. But rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Notice the contrast. The devil and the demons do not have their names written in heaven. Their name is scratched out of the ledger, and our name has been placed in the heavenly ledger. They lost their standing, and we are having our names placed there. And that's something to rejoice in, to think that we're in the heavenly register. Now, what happened in the world before the flood? It is reasonable to believe that Satan encouraged the angels to take the course that they did in marrying the daughters of men. Why? Because he wanted, we think, to try his hand at genetics. You know, that's the rage today, genetics. But Satan probably thought that through genetics he could overcome the condemnation to death. He wanted to make good on his lie, which he told Mother Eve, ye shall not surely die. And he thought that if he could infuse the heavenly vitality of the angels with the human race here, he could breed genetically a super race. Super race. I think we've heard that before, too, in our time. I think the Germans had the concept of a super race. Well, Satan's strategy only brought half of what he wanted. Yes, the angelic sons had vitality, but they had mutant genes, and they became hybrids, unable to produce a separate race apart from the Adamic stock. Even worse, they had the bad qualities of both sides. Sometimes children get the bad qualities of both parents. And this is what was happening with the fallen angels, with the children born to the fallen angels and the daughters of men. It wasn't a marriage made in heaven by any means. And the results were rather disappointing. We read in Genesis 6:11 and 12, now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. You know, a world that's filled with violence isn't going anywhere, is it? Certainly wasn't anything like the glory and honor and beauty of heaven. Here we find that their first attempt of the demons' involvement and Satan's hand at the government resulted in a very violent and difficult world. And I rather suspect that it was somewhat of a disappointment to Satan. His first experiment turned out very, very badly. You only need force or violence when others won't yield to your wishes. And apparently there was not anything much in the way of cooperation there. There was a lot of violence throughout the whole earth, and Satan seems to have lost control of events in that first world. Imagine how embarrassed Satan must have felt when he looked at what was wrought here on earth compared to the glory that existed in heaven. The peace, the order, the happiness, the serenity of heaven compared to the shouts of anger and violence that arose everywhere here on earth. Earth, with the emergence of sin and with the hand of the demons here on earth, had become a veritable snake pit. It started out badly and went from bad to worse. Satan's initial strategy was not working. He was not building a wonderful empire here on earth, but rather the angels who materialized before the flood were, as it were, a corrupting influence and destroying the glory and honor and dignity of man that was here. Now, the first world, we know, of course, ended with a flood, and the angels were placed at the end of that time in chains of darkness to prevent, we believe, their materialization and their active involvement in the affairs of the human race. And was Satan all upset about this? Well, we think not. I'm inclined to think that he was a little relieved because things were going nowhere very fast. They were going downward and self-destruct on a self-destruct course in the first world. In one sense, God could see that the Adamic children had been placed at an unfair advantage with the demons boldly dominating the human race. And so it was kind of unfair to men, too, because we were being put upon by a higher evil force, which was superior in strength, superior in vitality, and the poor human race really didn't have, you might say, a half a chance under those conditions. Some things, when they get messed up hopelessly, there's only one thing you can do, and that's destroy it and start all over again. You know, that sometimes is what has to be done. And the Lord chose that method. Now, after the flood, we find a new era arrived. The devil and the angels had a fresh start at a whole new world. Because only God-fearing people were left after the flood, the devil and his demonic hosts were kind of slowed down. They had a long cooling off period here. But it gave them time to not only cool off, but to make a more organized effort at controlling things in the second world. And we think here at this point Satan stepped in and he wanted to take center stage in controlling Earth's affairs. And the mechanisms that Satan used to control the world were going to be then and now. There are two things that he was going to use as the new controlling mechanism, and that is false religion and world government. Nimrod became a mighty hunter before the Lord, or in place of the Lord. Nimrod started the false religion of that era. He is alleged to have married his mother, and together they ruled before or in place of the Lord. In the land of Shinar, they built cities. You know, Nimrod was a great builder, probably one of the greatest builders of cities that man had ever had a capacity to build. Brilliant builder. We read in Genesis 11:1, "Now the whole earth had one language and few words." That's wonderful. Few words are the same words. You know, our world is so different today. We're filled with words, many words, and most of them we'd probably be better off without. But central to Satan's original plan was one world government. And, of course, to accomplish this, what did he do? They started to build the Tower of Babel. Come, let us build a city, we read in Genesis 11:4. Build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us, and notice, let us make a name. Let us make a name for ourselves. That was the new thrust in this second world. They were going to build a central government. They were going to organize it, put it under one domination. And of course, Satan would be at the top of it. And they would make a name for themselves. Here, unlike the first world built on raw pleasure, we see a more refined design. Power and glory was a part of the scheme, built upon the backs of mankind with Satan, as it were, on the throne, ruling this whole world dominion, all under his thumb, as it were. Well, that was his plan, but God didn't like that plan, did he? He moved very quickly, almost instantly, to end it. And he destroyed that original purpose in one stroke. He confused the tongues of men, and mankind thus was divided. And now Satan had a world that was divided by all kinds of languages, and if he got control of one, there would be another one that he would have to get control of, and how was he going to bring this one to work together with this group? And so it was very difficult for him to proceed with his one world concept. Satan and his demons found that God had placed a natural reign of law upon the earth. When one nation became too lax and undisciplined and too wicked and too devious, why, they were just destroyed and taken over by another nation. You read history. There's a reign of law in history. You can only go so far in wickedness until a more disciplined nation will come and take over. If you don't discipline yourself, if you don't take care of your affairs, you know, you look at even the fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbon shows all the things that brought about the end of the Roman Empire, and basically it was a lack of discipline, and others more disciplined simply came in. And so God has set limits. He's not only divided the world by languages, but he has put a reign of law. You can only go so far in evil until a more righteous arrangement will take over. Better disciplines will prevail. All right, then we see the world had another problem that Satan had to come to grips with. God had made a covenant with the nation of Israel. And here was another break, as it were, to Satan's control. The Lord gave a law to Israel. And through Israel, actually, the law of Israel has permeated to every civilized world, to every civilized nation in this world. What the law did was it labeled things. You know, it's very, today we are very concerned with labels, and we want to know what's in the box of Wheaties or whatever it is. Well, the law labeled things properly. It says this was right and this is wrong. This is righteousness. This is sin. And when you have matters properly labeled, it's a wonderful thing. When something is marked poison, you're glad to see that label because you know that that has to be treated in a certain way. And so that's what the law did. It placed proper labeling on the activities of men, and sin began to be properly identified. And even at the very end, we read in Revelation 7:1-3 that there have been restraining forces in this earth throughout the whole reign of mankind. But we see even at the very end that standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the earth or sea or against any tree until we have sealed the servants of God in their foreheads. Satan and his demons alike have had to deal with severe obstacles and limitations placed upon them from Babel until the present time. But we believe that in the judgment of the great day, there would be a loosing of these chains, and they would be given additional liberties. And this was Brother Russell's thought, and we think that really, as we study events and happening in the world, we see that Brother Russell was, as they say, right on target, as it were, in his evaluation. Now, what have the demons been doing throughout the age? We read in Deuteronomy 32:17, in the Song of Moses, Deuteronomy 32:17, that they sacrifice the demons, Leeser says, evil spirits. They sacrificed evil spirits, which were no gods, to gods they had never known. That is Moloch and Ashtaroth and Baal. Who were behind those false gods? Demons. That was demon religion. The fallen angels were involved in demonic religions. And most of these demonic religions had a certain, not only were they cast on a very low level, but they were designed to appeal to the weak passions of men. And while offering up human sacrifices, there was also provisions made to appeal to the base passions by performances of priests and priestesses. At times, the wickedness came within even the tabernacle. We find in 1 Samuel 2:22 that some of the evil practices that were taking place in these temples to the false gods was actually happening in the tabernacle itself. That's how corrupt it was, and that's how the demons swept in even to the holy things. The demons, or at least a strong block among them, have shown a strong preference for corrupting human sexuality, which God has intended the human race should keep sacred. They have also dealt with witchcraft and spirit possession on a very large worldwide scale. Wherever witchcraft has gone, there's always followed a general degradation of society. And that is the main reason why many of the civilized governments have proscribed witchcraft, is because where it has been allowed, there has been such rapid deterioration that it cannot be tolerated for long without destroying the fabric of civilization. And so it had to be limited because it had a self-destruct tendency to it. It destroyed the family and the fabric of society. But world domination had to wait until the kingdom was taken from Israel. The Lord gave his kingdom to Israel, and then we see for a certain short period of time how effective that kingdom became. Imagine from Satan's standpoint, he saw the Lord gave a kingdom to Israel, and then he saw that kingdom gradually emerge, how they took the promised land, they took Jerusalem, the holy city. And then through the period of the kings under David, under Saul and David, it began to rise in power and glory. And then under Solomon, Satan couldn't believe what was happening. Here was a kingdom, a golden kingdom, filled with honor and glory and wisdom and riches. And he was looking on. That's the kind of kingdom he would like to have. And it was standing in the way of his global designs. Imagine his frenzy in seeing such glory and peace and honor built into the kingdom of this earth. Instead of violence and corruption, Israel had nothing but peace and prosperity. But as he looked on, he could see there was a weakness there. It was a flawed reign, and by carefully attacking it together with the help of the demons, it lost the way of righteousness and turned into demon religions and corruption. And remember how we are told when Solomon was old, when he was old, not when he was young. When he was young, oh, he was vital, and he could take on all the forces that were against godliness. But when he became old, what did he do? he succumbed to the wishes of his wives. And he had married certain princesses from other great nations, and they would come and they would cry on his shoulder, you know, back home we had a temple to the goddess or the god, and we'd like one here, just a little one in Israel, so we could worship the way we did. And when he was young, he didn't hear his wives, but when he got old, he succumbed. And pretty soon, they had all of these types of temples that were built to the heathen gods. And of course, this incurred the divine displeasure. And finally, the kingdom began to fall. It was divided, and one, and we follow the reign of the kings. Each king was more wicked than the king before him, until finally we get to Zedekiah in 606 B.C., and I still think it's 606, not 586, but we read that, I will overturn it until he comes whose right it is, and I will give it to him. Ezekiel 21:27. And so we see that at the time that the Lord took away the kingdom of Israel, he was taking away one of the obstacles in the reign of Satan and the demons. So the Lord was stepping back, and he was going to allow universal dominion. But this was to be just an interregnum. And by interregnum, it means between the two kingdoms. The natural kingdom of Israel and the spiritual kingdom of Christ. There was a definite time period assigned, 2,520 years, and between these two kingdoms, the Gentiles were going to have dominion, and in a sense, the moment arrived for Satan and the demons to get their hands on world government. That which was standing in the way was removed, natural Israel. All right, we read in Daniel 7:2, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up on the great sea. Probably the same four winds of Revelation 7. We believe it has to do with the powers of spiritual control. And back there, the demons and Satan probably all wanted to express themselves in these various forms of world government. When they saw that the Lord was going to give four forms of universal empire, each wanted to try their hand at government. And what we think was that the way it worked out is that Satan said, all right, to keep peace, to keep these four winds from becoming a whirlwind right there and destroying any prospects for universal dominion, the compromise was reached between Satan and the demons, you know, like quarreling over an ice cream cone. The big brother has the ice cream cone, and he gives each of his three brothers a little lick, but he wants the main one for himself. And after they all get their lick, then he takes it. Well, we think that that's the way it was with the four universal empires. Babylon, some of the demons had that, and Medo-Persia, some other demons had that, and Greece, some of the other demons had that. But when it came to the Roman Empire, whose empire was that? Well, we're told it's the devil and Satan. That's his baby. That's his kingdom. That's the one that he is author of. That's the one that he dominates. He's the prince, the god of this world. That's his kingdom, his dominion. All right. And the only trouble with that is that after this kingdom, who's going to get it? It's going to be taken. It's going to be given to him whose right it is. And we believe the one whose right it is here. And there will not be any great universal empire after the 1914 reign of kings. We believe that we were right on target in the ending of the Gentile times. If the Bible students have had anything right, we've had that right. Sometimes I wonder if the students think we had much right at all. Actually, we were so right that it's unbelievable how on target we've been on so many things. We were on target on the restoration of Israel. Right on target, right on line. Ending of the Gentile times, the loosing of the demons, all these things. It's a part of the package of the harvest message, and really it's just unbelievable that anything could be so on target as what we have been following. All right, now, the return of the Lord has been an awesome thing here on earth. You know, the angels, the fallen angels, the demons, they can see, literally, they can see our Lord Jesus is here. And they can also see the saints with our Lord here. And while the churches are singing, Jesus is coming again, the demons must say, let's keep them singing that because they don't know what they're singing. He's here. And so they know who's in has the truth of the matter. They can see this very quickly. They can see, well, now this group of people, they know what's happening. These others, we've got them blindfolded. Keep them that way. And so they know also who are following the Master wherever He goes. They can see that. And what I'm trying to say is that the Lord's return has precipitated an enormous crisis in the powers of darkness and the evil spirit world. This has become a fearful and a judgmental time for them. The return of the Lord, which was invisible to the saints, is quite visible to the fallen angels. Not only so, in 1878, they witnessed, we believe, the raising of the sleeping saints. And they saw a large company gathered together with the Lord. And throughout the harvest, they have witnessed this one by one. This one and that one is caught up together to meet the Lord in the air. They see that. And so shall we ever meet, be with the Lord, we are told. So they are aware of what's happening. And it's frightening to them from one standpoint. I want to read from Brother Barton's article, just a paragraph in reprint 5865. 5865. In this article, Brother Barton used on the phenomena of Christ's return, saying, "The true Christ has already returned, but with our natural sight we cannot see Him. However, spirit beings like the devil and his angels can see Him. And as they behold our Lord doing successfully the preparatory work of the kingdom, while they are helpless to thwart the same, it must make them hate that Holy Son of God more than ever. How they must envy the human race who cannot see the Lord present, and must wish that they were human also, that they might not any longer behold the Lord. And must wish that they were human also, that they might not any longer behold the Lord, the one that they detest." Now that's a study in contrast. Here, the saints who cannot see the Lord, they love His presence. They love His appearing. But to the demons who can see Him, to them, it is a dark and awful time. They must find, of course, they must be like lepers who cannot really come directly into the presence of the Lord, but they must find themselves cowering and hiding from the glory of His presence. They must try to find ways of keeping their distance like a leper would have to. A leper had to stand off so many feet and say, unclean, unclean, unclean. Well, that's their position, I'm sure. They don't dare come, within certain limits of the Holy Ones. And so they must be hiding behind everything that they can hide behind to keep from being in the presence of such power and glory that is being assembled here on earth. And how frightening it must be to them. But on the other hand, You know, there's a minus side on from looking at it from their standpoint, but there's also a plus side. To their amazement, with the Lord's presence, the restraints that Satan had over them are being limited. And the demons who were once circumscribed completely by Satan are given greater liberties. And they're freer and freer and freer to do their own thing. And just when, you know, they tell us today that the biggest activity is in the transfer of information. That's the biggest thing going today. It's information passing on information. And just at the time when information is at an all-time high, the devils and the demons are getting into the information business, which we'll get into. So they have a lot of liberties, and that's exactly what the day of judgment is to bring to the demons. They were to be in chains until the judgment of the great day, and then these chains would gradually be released, and the Lord would watch and see their performance at this last. This would be their last act, as it were. He'd let them play it all out and do their thing, as it were, once more before they are destroyed, which we think is just very near ahead of us, the destruction of the demons. Now, one of the tools that they are using, of course, the demons have used many false religious tools throughout the age, but there's always been severe limitations on their progress. But today, one of the things that the fundamental churches are all upset about is the New Age movement. And, well, they should be. First, the New Age movement thrives on the same Madison Avenue techniques as the churches have been using. It uses celebrities, lots of them, more than the 700 Club and greater than the 700 Club. They have all the glitter, all the glitter and glamour of Hollywood stars running at the forefront of the New Age movement. Second, the New Age movement, they believe in the immortality of the soul just like the mainline churches. And that's a very fruitful field for misinformation. Transmigration into other forms of life, you know, as long as you've got to live forever, isn't it better to be, if you had a choice between being transmigrated into another life form, wouldn't that be better than going to hell and burning forever and ever with no hope of anything better? So it's fruitful in that respect. It's definitely kinder. The individual, according to the New Age movement, is simply recycled into another life form. That's more efficient than having to preserve them in hell forever. The very basic teaching of the fundamental churches provides a great deal of support for this New Age era. It is more economical. Instead of God having to give every human being a soul and provide for it somewhere in an ethereal hell, they simply can recycle this soul into different life forms, and on it goes. Third, the New Age movement is a great money-making scheme, rivaling the churches. The literature sales of this new religion are currently estimated, and this is just starting, about $1 billion a year. How is that for starters? There are 2,500 occult bookstores, 3,000 publishers of occult books, and this makes it catch the attention of corporate America. It's big business, and it's getting bigger every day and month of the year. It will begin to affect the religious sales of books in the mainline churches. Fourth, they purport to do good. The New Agers believe social and political activism is needed to help network, organize people of like mind to produce a united world, one world government, socially, economically, religiously, and politically. One world. Isn't that what Satan wanted? Fifth, while Christianity is forbidden in the school systems, the New Agers are having a heyday there. For example, Shirley MacLaine said, and I'm quoting from her, she's talking about a mystical experience she had while in a hot tub. She said, "My whole body seemed to float. Slowly, slowly, I became the water. I felt the interconnection of my breathing with the pulse of the energy around me. In fact, I was the air, the water, the darkness, the walls, the bubbles, the candle, the wet rocks under the water, and even the sound of the rushing river outside." Well, you may wonder what this has to do with the schools. Well, a sister out west told me in her school, the little children were told to lie on the floor, and they were told to believe that they were the sun, to feel the warmth and power of the sun, to be one with the sun, and to have the power of the sun in them. This is New Age religion, pure and simple. And it's not only in one school, it's being spread in many of the school systems. They believe and teach, but it isn't labeled religion. It's just a philosophy that is New Age philosophy, and so they get away with it in the school system. They believe and teach that God is in all and all are a part of God. Forsaking the idea that the Lord our God is one, which, by the way, the Trinitarians have done, they've added everybody to being a part of God. Not just three, but everybody is God. Additionally, the same school tells small children that they are to keep certain things hidden from their parents. They don't have to tell their parents what's going on in school. It is clear that they want to take over the education of children to the New Age religion. And we are told that occult film strips promoting seances and necromancy, which is contacting the dead, are used in some of the elementary schools. Tarot card readings have been offered in some McDonald's restaurant. University students are turning out by the thousands to hear hear guest lectures on the occult. And, of course, there is also the mixing of the occult and science. Six, the New Agers do not need ponderous theologians and theological schools. They use the host of demons. All they need is channelers. They don't call them mediums anymore. You know, the old radio where you had a channel, you had seven or eight channels, you'd dial it, and you'd come to one channel and another channel and another channel, and you'd select the channel you want. Well, that's the same thing they're telling you is with the demons. You simply have a channeler, and you can tie in to any demon that you'd like. You just choose the demon that you want, and the channeler will put you in contact with that demon. Now, Phil Donahue, Oprah Winfrey, and other major talk shows have endorsed spirit guides, and they've had them on their, they've had channelers right on their programs. I am told from what I read that on July 25th, 1986, actor and convert Michael York appeared on Merv Griffith's show with Jack Purcell. Jack Purcell was a channeler for the demon Lazarus. And he channeled Lazarus before an audience of millions of people. And of course, when the recently they gave out Emmy Awards, several of the actresses claimed that their success they owe to Lazarus. One of them says it was Lazarus. Another one said she owed her success to Mafu, channeled by the housewife Perry Torres. And so you see, the demons have no shortage of mediums. They don't need ponderous schools of theologians. The demons provide all the information. They have 6,000 years of information. They have superior intellect, and through these channelers, they can get into the mainstream of education today and information transfer. Now, we are told that there are, rattle off a few names, there's Lazarus, Mafu, Seth, Saint Germain, Ramtha. These are all demons that you could channel at will. There are over 1,000 mediums or channelers in the city of Los Angeles by itself. We can't name the number of channelers that there are in this country and in the world. Well, how does this channeling take place? Jack Purcell, who channels Lazarus, said that the entity unexpectedly possessed him one evening during meditation and began speaking through him. And he learned how to turn this into Madison Avenue big business. Now, a weekend seminar with Lazarus through the channeler, Purcell, cost $275 a person, with 600 to 800 people in attendance. That's $200,000 he makes a weekend just by providing contact with Lazarus. It costs $100 an hour for a private sitting with Lazarus, and you have to wait 2 years to get an appointment. Lazarus audio tapes sell for $20 per set, video tapes at $60. You can phone Lazarus at $53 a half an hour, and you can charge it to MasterCard or Visa. Now, this is no joke. This is real. It's scary. It's a terrible thing, but this is the way it is. Books are not exempt from demonism. Yes, many in Christian bookstores and on the bestsellers list of the evangelical churches, they're finding out in the evangelical bookstores there are books that have been channeled by demons. And, you know, the fundamentalists, their hair is standing on end. Now, they don't know how many of their books have been channeled by demons. It's an awful situation for them. For instance, Richard Box, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, which was one of the bestsellers, which was run in most of the Christian bookstores, was supernaturally written. So the demons are not only communicating through channelers, but they're using channelers to write books and information. They have been active and are active in this. They can channel through people with doctor's degrees. They can channel through people who are writing the college textbooks. They can, as it were, spread their misinformation, they call it now, everywhere. Another thing, Laura Cameron Fraser, the first woman Episcopal priest of the Pacific Northwest, chose to resign as rector of her church rather than to renounce her faith in a channel spirit named Jonah. She was honest enough to say, even though she had this high position in the church, that she was a channeler for Jonah. Now, there's a lot of them that are not that honest. They may be channelers, but they're not saying it. She owned up to it, and she was put out of the church. Then also crystals. You are probably aware that the new look is crystals. The demons, through the New Agers, claim crystals vibrate to energy patterns of God and can help a person feel and use this energy. Well, we used to call them charms and omelets or whatever it was, but now these crystals are vibrating so that you can get in tune with the demons. Well, what is the goal? We believe the demons are using Madison Avenue techniques. They've given up on Christian Science and they've gone Madison Avenue now, and they're reaching the main line of people in a way that is quite frightening. In a few short years, they have captured countless millions of people in high places, and especially the young. And they are using this, as it were, to gain control. In other words, this is an opportunity. The Lord has removed the restraints, and the demons have seen an opportunity to go Madison Avenue to gain control of the minds of men, and we believe they are doing it on a wholesale basis. You know, before, what could the demons do? Before the advent of our Lord, they were rapping and they were tapping and they were moving tables and they were slamming doors and moving curtains, but they couldn't communicate, could they? Now, they're in the information mainstream. They're here. They are speaking. They are writing. They are being channeled into the mainstream of our whole education and information process. Now, we believe that this is a test for the angels, the fallen angels who may have repented and wish to return to favor with God and our present Lord. You know, we believe that some of them probably have repented. We can't be sure, but that was Brother Russell's thought, and I think it's a correct one. That this judgment, they've suffered, a lot of these demons have suffered for 6,000 years, and they want to return to God and to righteousness. And so they find themselves put upon, on one hand, by the evil demons that have not repented, but they must be the ones that have repented want to come nearer to the Lord, and they want to throw off the shackles of darkness. And so we believe this is a time of special trial for them too. And they must be encouraged when they see the saints with painstaking efforts trying to live godly, holy lives. It must be a sermon to the angels that have repented. Now, I want to epitomize briefly the New Age beliefs. First, the New Age believe that God is an impersonal, all-pervading energy. Similar to what some Christians believe when they allege that God is everywhere and in everything. We don't believe that. God is a person. And He is a very glorious being. And we don't believe He is in everything and everywhere. But He has a dwelling place. And He is a person. But that's one of the ideas, the false ideas that they have capitalized on. If God is in everything, and He's in this table, and He's in this glass, and in everything, well, then, you know, then, of course, the New Age movement would have something to work with. The Holy Spirit, they say, is an energy that can be used creatively or psychically. Jesus Christ, oh, they say He was wonderful. He was He was a New Age teacher and an illustration of an enlightened individual who knew He was God. Just what the Trinitarians say, that He knew He was God, and so He didn't have to spend His life finding out His identity, but because He knew He was God, He was in contact to use that power and so that's why He was so effective. Man, they say, inwardly is good and divine. Everything that's good is within us. We have all the seeds of goodness within us. All we have to do is kind of get the watering can and sprinkling on ourselves, and all that goodness will come out. Don't believe it. Man is wicked, and his heart is desperately evil. And if you use the watering can on it, you're just going to get the worst crop of evil you ever saw. Salvation, that's a development of psychic powers and higher consciousness. This is achieved by looking inside oneself and practicing New Age techniques to finally attain awareness of our personal divinity. Sin, well, all that is ignorance of our personal divinity. Death, the moment one hopes to experience emerging with God, the all-pervading influence of the universe. This only comes if personal transformation or enlightenment has been obtained. In other words, if you get to that certain point, you have, it's like the Oriental religions, you have karma, you're one with God then. Satan is just our normal consciousness, man existing in his state of unrealized potential. That's all Satan is. Heaven and hell, that's good and bad states of consciousness in this life. That's a thumbnail sketch of the New Age philosophy. Well, I've spent more time on this than I really care to, but in order to understand these matters, we have to see how it all serves in God's purpose. Brother Russell felt the evil spirits would be given greater liberties at the day of the Lord as it continued, and certainly we believe that this is true. They are emerging, and they are emerging with such vitality and with such force that it is almost frightening to think about. And if they are able to be in the information track right now, we believe that it's not too far flung an idea that Brother Russell expressed that they might additionally be given the powers to materialize. Certainly their influence is being felt in the world as never before in history from the time of the flood. Now, trying to understand this, you know, our nominal Christian friends, they're hysterical over the New Age movement. They see this as a threat to their church state hopes and aspirations. Here they have been...